Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
This is Tom Gilson, and today I am happy to bring you part one of an interview from a recent closed-door event at Discovery Institute's headquarters in Seattle, Washington. It was the Intelligent Design Action Networking Meeting, and Discovery Institute's Jonathan Witt interviewed DI Senior Fellow, philosopher, mathematician, and author David Berlinski about his new book, Human Nature. Berlinski joined via a video link from his apartment in Paris.
We're here today to discuss human nature, which of course gives us a lot of room to maneuver because you cover a lot of different topics. It's an exciting book. I'd like to read one of the endorsements that came in very late, just in time to make it into the book. These essays represent a reflection on man and modern times as erudite as the finest history, as profound as the most searching philosophy, as beautifully wrought as the loveliest prose, and as shocking and indignant as the best journalism, the work of a magnificent mind. And that was from Peter Robinson, the Murdoch Distinguished Policy Fellow at the Hoover Institution and host of Uncommon Knowledge. And we saw a little bit of him interviewing Berlinski, Meyer, and Gelernter yesterday. And by the way, he also has a nice interview with Berlinski. So if you go to Uncommon Knowledge and then just search for Berlinski, you'll find that excellent interview there. The new book, Human Nature, it's a collection of essays that bear either directly or indirectly on the question of what is man? What is the nature of man? And perhaps the essay that best or most directly tackles that question of what is the nature of human nature is the essay entitled The Social Set. And there, Berlinski takes on Yale thinker Nicholas Christakis, and in particular, his book, Blueprint, The Evolutionary Origins of a Good Society. The book's thesis, roughly, is that the same evolutionary process that brought us down from the trees, out onto the savannas, and eventually into Starbucks, it also equipped us nicely with a suite of beneficial inclinations, cooperation, love, learning, camaraderie. Evolution, in sum, gifted us with a suite of traits that press human society onward and upward, even if not always in a straight line. So here's the first question, David. To that thesis, what do you say?
Insofar as it involves a scientific hypothesis, namely, there is something we understand completely that is responsible, causally responsible for widespread human traits or properties or attributes. It's nonsensical. There is no such theory. We have no insight into the mechanism that produced love, altruism, comradeship, theory making, social life, intelligent exploration. All of these certainly are traits or properties of human beings, but they emerge in every human society as far as we can tell. And they have no anterior explanation that makes a great deal of sense. I mean, after all, the idea of a gene for love, that is a biochemical entity that produces a complex emotional state, social state, often a political state as marriage, is simply incoherent. Genes don't do that sort of things. Genes interact with other genes. In a certain way, Berkeley in the 18th century was right. The only thing that can influence a thought is another thought. It's pointless to look at biochemistry for an explanation of human life. It's not completely irrelevant. There are certain circumstances. For example, if you remove a man's liver or his lungs, he won't have a rich emotional life. We can go that far. But going much further into evolutionary explanation seems to me seriously, seriously compromised at this stage of our understanding. That's not to say that they're not universal features of human life. Surely there are. But the suite of optimistic features that Christakis advances has to be balanced against the other side. It has to be balanced, for example, against the original sins of humanity, which have been long noted. There is a desperate wickedness to the human race, as well as an instinct for comradeship, and that too is part of the balance sheet.
Yeah, Christakis seems to neglect the latter in his book. There's a kind of Whiggish dimension to it. We'll talk about another book with a kind of techno-Whiggish dimension to it here in a bit. don't want to stay with Chris Stocker.
To interrupt you, I don't think it's fair to say that this is a sophisticated guy, and he comes from an interesting Greek background, and he's been exposed to the nature of the world. It's not that he is ignorant of this aspect of human life. He has just chosen rhetorically and ideologically not to emphasize it. That's a different issue. It's a quite different issue.
Right. He has an optimism that these more positive qualities will predominate. And your book presents a lot of evidence that there is not the upward trend that some people would suggest. We'll talk about that more here in a minute. Christakis, this is the same Christakis in the infamous YouTube video some of you may be familiar with. And this is a video on the campus of Yale, and it's there on the grounds of Yale when there's this professor and the student comes along and starts haranguing him. And the context is that Christakis, his wife, who was also working at Yale, was encouraging students, there was an email, encouraged students to not be cowed into surrendering their right to free expression when it came to Halloween costumes. There had been a previous email from the administration that she worried would kind of give the Yale students the sense that they did not have that freedom of expression. And so she wrote to encourage them, you know, use good sense, but you have that right. The administration was worried that students would show up in vile, tasteless Halloween costumes, as young people are wont to do. Well, anyway, you'd think it all seemed fairly benign, but there was this huge dust-up, and Christakis came to the defense of his wife, and then there were these students that wanted to stamp out, you know, any possibility of a student showing up in some politically insensitive type of Halloween costume, and she absolutely rips him up and down, you know, screaming at him at the top of her lungs. And he keeps his cool, and then he later writes about the situation. Eventually, his wife gets pressured out of Yale. He gets pressured out of his administrative position, though he continues there as a professor. And he writes this optimistic note in an email, kind of as the dust he's hoping will settle. He says that he remains hopeful that students at Yale can express themselves and engage complex ideas within an intellectually plural community. And of course, that sentiment is near and dear to the heart of Discovery Institute as we seek the intellectual freedom of our fellows to talk about intelligent design. So my question, David, is Christakis's optimism well-grounded?
Well, look, I think we can make much too much of the fact that Christakis and any number of other academicians have been abused by adolescent hysterical reptiles. To tell you the truth, I remember behavior on my own part in a very dissimilar political context that was not much more by way of elegant than the behavior that you're reporting. I don't think we should pay all that much attention to that. What is astonishing, two facts remain. One is that Christakis and his wife, and I watched the videos very carefully, never really defended themselves. They attempted to reason with clearly what was an unreasonable group of students. Jordan Peterson does a much better job. He just barks back. And the second is that Christakis was not defended by the university. And I found that just astonishing. The students should have been expelled instantly. It's what would have happened before 1963-64. At Columbia, for example, if you behaved that way with respect to the dean of students, you were simply expelled. No administrative laxity. Yale did nothing, and I find that astonishing.
Okay.
But you had a second question.
Yeah.
You had a second question. What does this suggest about the influence of orthodoxy? And I think there is some carryover. What we're seeing on the campuses is a kind of hysterical religious revival without religion. It has all the attributes of some explosion of the religious impulse without any of the apparatus or the architecture that would make that rational or theologically interesting. It's just an explosion. But that has a correlative in the academic world at large and the larger world of social political discourse. And I should begin that answer by saying, in certain respects, of course, we expect powerful forces of orthodoxy to predominate any institution that outlives the individual. As lawyers say, the law was not made in a day. They say it for good reason. You can't rebuild the law in one day. But that said, what we are seeing is the intellectual privileges extended to the law, to particle physics, or to mathematics, now being demanded for studies like gender studies, intersectional theory, various departments of ethnic studies, the whole body of doctrine that has penetrated the academic world is now immured in the wall of orthodoxy. And dissent is not only not tolerated, it's actively punished to the extent that the people doing the punishing think they have the power to get away with it.
Another essay in the collection that's very explicitly occupied with human nature is, in your anthology, is entitled Godzooks. Not Gadzooks, but Godzooks. We'll play on words there. The subject there, or I might say your victim there, is Yuval Noah Harari. He's the author of Sapiens. Some of you may be familiar with him. And more recently, Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow. Harari vies with Christakis for Pollyannish optimism, if you will. The difference being that Harari stirs in a beaker full of what you might call techno-utopianism. And you write, allow me just to read a brief excerpt here. In Sapiens, Harari expressed no very great use for the monotheistic religions of mankind, nor for the agricultural practices that he supposed made them possible. He commended Stone Age cultures with the enthusiasm of a man not required to live in any of them. For all that, Sapiens was very much a work of weak history, an account of successive revolutions, each prefiguring the next. In Homo Deus, Harari argues that human beings are shortly to be improved, greatly so. For a start, better genes, better neural circuits, better biochemistry thereafter, a variety of implantable contraptions, chips, stents, or shunts. Finally, a full promotion to the pantheon, computer science at last inscribing intelligence in inorganic matter, the old-fashioned human body declining into desuetude, replaced by the filaments and files of an alien form of life. Okay, for Christakis, it was Darwinian evolution that shaped and set human nature on an irresistibly Whiggish upward trajectory. For Harari, it seems to be a brave new world of science doing much of the work. And I use that term brave new world intentionally, a reference, of course, to the 20th century novel. So my question, David, is Harari right? Will techno-utopian evolution succeed where Darwinian evolution seems to be failing in terms of, you know, raising up human nature to some great new level? Is the new man just a singularity away?
No.
Next question. I don't have a chance. No, please elaborate.
Harari is an interesting figure. He was trained as a military historian, oddly enough. He's an obsessive vegetarian. He demotes himself from the public arena 1 month in a year to meditate solemnly. And he has developed an avid cult following. He is interesting in that he is an example of someone who, having vowed never to fall in love again, instantly falls in love with the first attractive face or theory that he happens to come upon. Given his schedule, the most attractive face or feature comes from Silicon Valley, and it appears to him as a crackpot scientific theory. He falls instantly. And I confidently expect that a book or two in the future will reject these enthusiasms with the maturity of advancing years. But everything he says is largely nonsensical, as is the idea of a singularity that's going to promote human beings into a closer identification with a digital computer. God forbid we get any closer to the iPhone. But at each moment of his expressed infatuation, anybody who looks at the literature can see that the underlying claims are simply absurd. They're preposterous. Human beings are what they have always been, smarter in some respects because knowledge is cumulative, dumber in other respects because memory is fallible. But the idea that as a result of developments in Silicon Valley, within 10, 20 years, roughly the same time as the climate apocalypse, which also figures in this demonology, we're going to undertake a massive promotion to a world in which we appear as an aspect of a computer. Hey, that's just nuts. Is there anything more to be said? It's just nuts. It's not going to happen. It won't work. We have no idea what we're doing. We can't even get close to a goal of that nature. And we certainly can't say what it would mean.
Thank you, David. I don't want to leave the impression that we have given you more than just a small taste of the riches of this book, Human Nature. There's much more here. There are, for instance, positive, endearing, what's the word I'm looking for? There are parodies to such writers as Isaac Bashevis Singer, Gabriel Garcia Marquez. I think there are one or two others. So there's fiction in this. There's short stories in here as well. Just to give you a sense of randomness, there's also if you speak French, near the end, there's actually an interview. He was interviewed by one of the largest national newspapers in France. That's in there. There's also a great interview that David Klinghoffer did with him late. So it's a smorgasbord. It's a wonderful collection. Let's close it out with another round of a thank you for David.
That was Jonathan Witt interviewing philosopher David Berlinski about his newest book, Human Nature. You can find it at discoveryinstitutepress.com or at Amazon or BN.com. Read the glowing endorsements from Peter Robinson, Yale University's David Gelernter, Stanford's Victor David Hansen, and others. Go check it out. For ID the Future, this is Tom Gilson. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.